This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The 2018 primary election may end up being remembered for turnout as much as anything. The final figures are still unknown, but the state estimates that more than 2 million people cast votes on Tuesday. We're going to get some primary analysis from Western Michigan University political science professors John Clark and Peter Wielhauer. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks, Gordon.
Always a pleasure.
Could turnout in a primary tell us anything about what could or might happen in November? John, you want to start?
Well, it certainly could tell us, and we never know exactly for sure what it's going to tell us until we get there. But I think one of the things that we see with turnout here in Michigan, but also turnout in other states as they hold elections throughout the summer, is that people are engaged in politics in a way that we don't often see in a mid-year election cycle. When we get to the presidential election years, people are at least paying attention to who's running for president. But oftentimes, mid-year election or midterm elections go under the radar. And what we're seeing now is a level of excitement on both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, that we often don't see. My guess is that's going to lead to a much more animated campaign season and higher turnout in November at the general election stage.
I think that's right. The big story of the year seems to be the excitement on the Democratic side, but it seems pretty clear that Donald Trump and the grassroots within the Republican Party is able to generate responsively to that, generate votes responsively to that, so that they are turning out just as well. And so you're seeing extremely competitive races where people are talking about very strong Democratic turnout, but it's really both sides.
Now let's take a look here at a couple of races in Southwest Michigan. Matt Longjohn is the Democratic nominee in the 6th Congressional District and will challenge Fred Upton in November. Does his win tell us anything about what Democrats are likely to do in the fall, John?
Well, I think we're likely to see an engaged set of Democratic voters. The challenge always in the 6th Congressional District is, can you get enough Democrats and enough folks who are neither Democratic identifiers or Republican identifiers to turn out on Election Day? Fred Upton does a pretty good job of not only mobilizing Republicans, getting support of Republicans, but also winning independent voters. So that's definitely going to be the challenge, as it is every time. But higher Democratic turnout, a mobilized base, and if it is a good year for Democrats, that could be a good sign for the 6th District Democrats.
Matt Longjohn is going to have the same problem that Democrats have in the 6th District and have for a long time. That is, it's a district that's largely been drawn in order to elect and reelect and reelect Fred Upton, Republicans generally, but Fred Upton specifically. And there has not been the fundraising capability to really take on an entrenched incumbent with a very large war chest like Fred Upton. So those are two really large hills to climb in terms of Matt Longjohn's ability to be successful.
But Matt Longjohn in particular, and Democrats in general, really, if you also look at George Franklin's fundraising numbers, have definitely brought more money into the 6th district than they have in the past. There will certainly be an advantage on the Republican side. But is this maybe the unknown here? Can that money that's raised, and assuming that there's more coming in some way, maybe produce a different outcome in November?
I think a big piece of the more money coming in part of the equation is whether national Democrats are convinced that Upton is beatable. Currently in the national scale of things, in all of the people like Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball and Charlie Cook's Political Report, Fred Upton is not seen at all as being in play with regard to this district. And as I think it was an MLive article noted yesterday, that it took four Democrats to generate $1.7 million, and Fred Upton comes to the table with $2 million in the bank. So I think that it's really a steep hill.
And it isn't just about money for money's sake. It's about money for a candidate who, yes, captured the Democratic nomination, but really has to introduce himself to general election voters throughout the district. The best way to do that is still probably television, although television viewing habits have certainly changed dramatically. But how do you do that? How do you introduce yourself to voters in a way that works in your favor? And if he's able to do that, then certainly he has a chance. If it seems as though he might be able to do that, then that's going to bring in more money, which then can be used to try and introduce himself and to contest the general election.
John's right. It's not just about the money. It's about what the money does for you. And if you can generate enough money to leverage that into a really strong and effective grassroots effort, get out the vote effort, and the really expensive stuff, which is the mass media, to get people to pay attention to you, that is what the money buys you. But that money is kind of, what do we need to open the door to allow us, the Democrats, the flexibility to accomplish that?
Pete, you noted that the most recent analysis from stuff like the Cook Political Report, Larry Sabato's crystal ball, still leave the 6th Congressional District as at least likely Republican, I think, in both of those, if I remember correctly. It seems like the last few election cycles, someone has blasted an email out with one poll that shows Fred Upton is vulnerable, or words to that effect. And of course, in all of those election cycles, obviously, he went on to win a comfortable re-election victory. If we were looking for a sign out there that that was somehow shifting in any way, what might it be? Could it simply be money coming in from the outside, which shows that there must be internal polling that indicates a closer race than we might think right now?
Well, we saw that with Paul Clement's campaign in 2014 in particular, where we had a lot of outside money that was coming in, at least, if I recall, maybe $500,000 that came from outside groups that saw his candidacy as really viable to take out Fred Upton. But in the end, that's only $500,000. That's not really enough to take on an entrenched incumbent, and it just requires more than that. I think it's just very difficult in a district drawn this way, with an incumbent that has a lot of money and a lot of personal networks, I think it's just very difficult for Democrats to win here. I think it can be done, but it would take something like a major scandal involving Fred Upton. It's not enough for him to be connected to the party of a controversial president. It's got to be something more specifically geared toward him. It's just not clear that there's anything in the closet waiting for that to happen.
And I think with many races across the country this year, there are going to be a lot of Democrats who want to make their election, a referendum on Donald Trump. I think there are an awful lot of Republican candidates who are going to want to focus on local issues. Fred Upton has been in office long enough that it's relatively easy for him to talk about who he is as a candidate, divorced from whatever is going on in national politics. He's done that very effectively for a long time, and it seems like that would be his best strategy again in this election cycle.
Fred Upton is a Republican who never actually endorsed Donald Trump for president, even through the November election in 2016. Many of those Republicans ended up facing primary challenges, and that actually worked its way down to the state House level. In this neck of the woods, Dave Maturin, who had also never endorsed Trump, he actually said that sitting in this very studio, that he wouldn't say who he was voting for, but did say that he could not endorse Donald Trump. He ended up being defeated on Tuesday by Matt Hall. How rare is it, even, you know, especially in the term limits era, when, you know, people aren't going to be there that long, and oftentimes people will kind of wait for their shot, to see an incumbent state representative defeated?
It doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen very often at the congressional level. It doesn't happen very often at the state legislative level either. And as you point out, Gordon, with the advent of term limits here in Michigan, there's always going to be an open seat coming soon. And oftentimes it's easier to win an open seat both at the primary level and at the general election level than it is to defeat an incumbent in a primary or in a general election contest. So it is pretty unusual. One of the other things, though, that's pretty unusual is that Matt Hall, the challenger, raised an awful lot of money, at least for a state legislative primary, and was able to go on television and to, you know, sort of introduce himself on his own terms in what really in some ways is an information-starved political environment, was enough to convince a number of folks in that district that he was the guy.
So Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, in his concession video, which he put out Tuesday night, congratulated Bill Schuette and told the people who had campaigned for him that they had to accept that this is President Trump's Republican Party now. Peter, as we look at that 63rd State House District race, where David Maturin was defeated running for re-election, and also look at Donald Trump endorsing Bill Schuette, who won big. Maybe his endorsement didn't mean much there. But then John James, who was in a pretty tight race for the Republican primary for U.S. Senate, defeated Sandy Pensler. Can we say that this is Donald Trump's Republican Party, especially in Michigan right now?
Well, I think that the sitting president is always the head, considered to be the head of their national political party. In the case of Donald Trump, we really have a situation where you have an extremely unusual person at the head of the, as the titular head of the political party. We've seen that he can make a difference, that his endorsement makes a difference in terms of who wins and who loses, that in the Republican primaries, we know that Republican primary voters are quite conservative and they are diehard Republicans, and that Donald Trump has brought in a new cohort of people into the Republican Party and has alienated a different cohort from the Republican Party, and that the net effect of that, it means that the people who are in voting in the Republican primaries are more like Trump than they were 5 years ago. And so as a result, we have seen the case where we've got primaries at the state legislative race, in the congressional races, Senate races, and so forth, in which connection to Donald Trump is seen as a badge of honor within the Republican Party candidates. And the people who are ambivalent or are perceived to be ambivalent about him, they really run a risk with the Republican voters when they aren't willing to back the president.
I think one of the interesting wrinkles on this is that while certainly it helps at the primary stage, what's the impact going to be at the general election? There are a number of particularly legislative districts that are drawn in ways that it's going to be hard for whoever wins that Republican nomination to lose the general election. And the same thing is certainly true on the Democratic side in terms of redistricting. But in those races that are in districts that are more evenly balanced between Republicans and Democrats, what's going to happen to those voters who don't think of themselves as either Republicans or Democrats? If they are folks who are favorable at the time of the general election to Donald Trump, then that certainly would help a Republican candidate. But if they're not, then that might help a Democrat to win, even in a district where we would expect a Republican typically to be successful. That's, at this point, still the unknown, but it also creates some interesting challenges for Republican candidates as they think about how they want to frame their general election strategy.
What we know from watching candidates over the last 40 or 50 years is that, in general, in primaries, Republicans tend to run to the right, Democrats tend to run to the left, and then for the general elections, they tend to run to the center to try to capture those middle voters who are not primary voters. I think the challenge for Republicans this year is that it's not an ideological race. I mean, they call themselves conservatives, but Donald Trump is not particularly conservative in his long history. He's pursuing some conservative policies now, but now he is the compass, if you want, of Republican orthodoxy. And so I think that a lot of Republicans are now saying, in order to win the primary, I have to align myself with Donald Trump, but how deftly can I pivot to some kind of weird ideological Trumpian center that will enable them to not alienate enough people to win in the fall? That's going to be a challenge. It depends on the quality of the candidates. If it turns out that some of the Republican candidates who won their primaries are people like Todd Akin, who make significant strategic and messaging mistakes, or Christine O'Donnell, who just make terrible errors in their campaigning, then they're not going to win. But if they turn out to be reasonably good, consistent, and reliable candidates, then they can bank on a certain percentage of the Republican vote. And then the rest of it is really trying to build coalitions.
Might it, though, get tricky when you look at President Trump's approval ratings in places like Michigan? It's not very high. I don't have it in front of me, but I think high 30s, maybe low 40s, somewhere in there. And at the same time, trying to generate enthusiasm on your side. I mean, do you really walk a fine line? Because the enthusiasm gap is one of the things that has Republicans concerned. One way to mitigate that may be to animate the hardcore supporters of President Trump. But do you then run the risk of playing into that rather low approval rating of the president's?
Well, here's where Donald Trump has been really an interesting campaigner for Republican candidates during the whole set of special elections that we've seen over the last 18 months or so, where his imprimatur on a candidate can kind of make or break the candidate, but his involvement, his willingness to campaign, to endorse, to tweet on behalf of individual candidates drives some turnout. And that has made a difference. It's made races that might not have been close, closer. And it's made turnout that would have been mediocre, a little bit better than mediocre. And even without going to the place where Donald Trump claims credit for all of these wins and all these victories, I think that it's easy to say that a lot of the differences that we've seen in some of the elections have been because of his involvement. So my big question then is, what does that look like when you're talking about trying to spread out that energy, that ability to mobilize, that ability to influence people and get people excited when you're talking about 100 races as opposed to one or two races here or there for a little while? You're talking about a sustained 2 or 3 month campaign on a lot of races all over the country in all kinds of districts. It'll be interesting to see if Donald Trump can sustain that kind of energy and excitement in that context.
And the flip side of that Trump effect late on behalf of Republican candidates is that a number of these races should not have been close at all. They should have been easy wins for Republicans, but for the Trump presidency, which allowed Democrats to make those races a lot closer than most people would have expected. If Trump sort of comes in at the end and consolidates that Republican support and a Republican ekes out a narrow victory, then he can take credit for that. But the fact that it was a narrow victory is also something that is his responsibility in a negative way, I suppose.
And we've seen a lot of races where that's the case, where race after race, the difference is much closer. Now, in some of those analyses, I sometimes wonder if they're kind of cherry picking the results. So MSNBC's analysis last night, they were all comparing the difference in the Republican turnout this year with the 2016 presidential election year with a lot more information. To me, that seems kind of, that's not really a fair comparison. You want to look at the previous 2014 as a better comparison, but it doesn't allow you to control for Donald Trump. And so that becomes part of the problem. I think the biggest issues that are related to the Republicans this year have something to do with President Trump's approval or disapproval ratings, but also have to do with just historical patterns. We know that the president's party just runs huge risks during a midterm election year, and in particular, when you've got a large number of seats that are exposed like the Republicans do this year. Large number of retirements, and that's really putting a lot more seats in play this year than we've otherwise seen. And that's going to make things tougher for the Republicans. The countervailing effects of a pretty good economy, it's unclear that that's going to be able to overcome just the scale of the exposure and Donald Trump's differential approval ratings in these different states.
And that larger factor of who's sitting in the White House seems to be especially true in Michigan, where in our lifetimes, there have only been a very small number of cases where the governorship has, which is in midterm elections, has been won by a candidate from the president's party. Almost never happens. And that seems like it would be a good sign for Gretchen Whitmer and for the Democrats, irrespective of the fact that it's Donald Trump who is the Republican in the White House rather than just some Republican.
So let's take a look here at both parties and talk about what was the best and worst news to come out of Tuesday, starting with the Democrats. John, you want to go first?
I think The best news for the Democrats, perhaps, was Gretchen Whitmer's winning of the gubernatorial nomination. On paper, in terms of experience and everything else, it would seem as though she would have been the logical candidate. And her relatively comfortable win in that nominating race suggests that Democratic primary voters were able to see that.
She did win every county throughout the state.
And, her opponents were folks who had not held elected office before, but were pretty well funded. And Sri Tanadar, particularly spending his own money, had some fantastic ads, didn't necessarily give us too much information about why he should be governor necessarily, but he was out there and visible in a way that often isn't the case. And yet that didn't translate into votes yesterday, and Whitmer won pretty comfortably. I think that sets us up for a really interesting gubernatorial race against two candidates with long histories in politics who've been successful campaigners in the past, and there's no reason to think they won't be in the general election cycle this year as well.
Anything troubling for the Democrats to come out of Tuesday?
Well, I think it's, we've talked a little bit about some challenges for Republicans in terms of consolidating their support. I think the same thing is true for Democrats, that there's a real rift between sort of the remnants of the Sanders campaign and the remnants of the Clinton campaign, the progressives versus the establishment wings of the Democratic Party. To the extent to which Democrats are able to consolidate that here in Michigan and across the country, then that's going to be helpful to them in the general election. to the extent to which that rift continues to fester, it's going to make it that much harder for Democrats to capitalize on what really should be a good year for the Democratic Party nationwide.
If it turns out that there are any kind of accusations after the election from, say, folks from the Abdul Sayed campaign, that there are improprieties on the part of the Whitmer campaign or manipulation of the system somehow, I think that could really energize more the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party in Michigan and create the kind of hard feelings that we saw after the 2016 presidential primaries between Clinton and Sanders. I agree that the difficult news for the Democrats is what to do about the ideological cats that they're trying to herd within the party itself. That said, I think that Nancy Pelosi a few weeks ago essentially said, look, our strategy is to make every race local. You go by your local context. This was after the Ocasio win in New York. If democratic socialism works in New York City, then use it there. If it doesn't work in Kalamazoo, don't use it in Kalamazoo. So you have to find the local strategy. And so people who are trying to find a cohesive center for what the Democratic Party is are going to have a hard time doing that because she's basically instructing them to do what you need to do to win where you are, and we'll worry about the rest of it later.
And what about Republicans? What's the best thing for them to come out of Tuesday?
I think the best thing to come out of Tuesday for them is the James candidacy. I think having an African-American veteran who's the Republican standard bearer for the United States Senate, I think that's a really good sign for the Republican Party. Some people will come after him as in a harshly critical way, saying that he's sold out because he's African-American and Republican in an era of Trump. But I think for the Republicans, I think that it's going to provide them an ability to deflect arguments that they are all racists. And so I think that they're going to see that as something that's strong. I also think that if the Republicans can consolidate behind Bill Schuette, put aside their internal divisions, that would be a good thing. That still remains to be seen. Sounded okay on their concession speeches last night, but it remains to be seen what happens to their ground games.
But did some of those accusations that the Cowie campaign threw at Schuette, are those the sort of things that may stick a little more than simple differences on issues? I mean, you know, Shady Schuette and the charges of using, you know, state taxpayer dollars for political things. I mean, those are things that the other side, isn't it maybe a little easier for the other side to pick that up and run with it than it would be, say, a difference over, you know, a social issue or even a tax issue?
It is. And the when those charges came out over the last few weeks, the key question that I ask myself when it comes to campaigns is this going to change anybody's vote? And it's not clear that kind of stuff that's kind of on the edges, especially having those public meetings or doing political business on the state time. I think for most people, that is much ado about nothing and they don't care about it. People who are going to vote Republican, they are not going to have their vote changed by something small like that. They can be changed by significant financial improprieties and those kinds of things. But this kind of staffing questions, that's so technical that I think that most Republican voters are not going to care about it. Will some independents care about it? They might, but they probably were going to vote Democrat anyway. It's not clear to me how that kind of messaging shifts the strategy in such a way that people's votes are really going to be changed as a result of that message.
I think it does depend on whether it sticks and whether there's more to it. And if there is, then it certainly could. Not for people who are going to vote Republican anyway, but for those folks who sometimes vote for Republican candidates, sometimes vote for Democratic candidates, for those folks, it could make a difference. And you got to win some of those. You got to win a lot of those in a state like Michigan that's a competitive state in order to win the general election. I think for me, the best thing coming out of the primary for Republicans is that their turnout was up too. And we've talked already about turnout and about an enthusiasm gap, but Republicans showed in the primary, and I think that they've got to look at that and say, okay, we've got a chance, not just at the top of the ticket, but all across the state for all kinds of elective office. And in many ways, the deck's already stacked in their favor statewide, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays national with the national dynamics that we've talked about as well.
And it'll be interesting to see for Michigan Republicans, if they are able to retain control of the state Senate and the state House and Gretchen Whitmer is elected governor, how do they handle a scenario in which we've got divided government at the state level? What does that mean in terms of public policy? What does that mean in terms of what they want getting their agenda passed? Because they've pretty much had a free hand for a long time. And so to have that executive checking that power would be new to a lot of them.
John Clark and Peter Wielhauer are political science professors at Western Michigan University. Thank you both. We'll have a lot to talk about in the fall.
You bet.
Thanks, Gordon.
More coverage of Tuesday's primary can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.